Why are Western Europeans so naive? Well, I have to start with a disclaimer, or a little trigger warning. I have no idea how racist this question is. Assuming applying something negative about a group of people probably is racist, but then a Westerner implying something negative about Westerners would just be Western self-hatred, and I should get a lot of positive anti-racist points, I think, for that. But then this question now is usually asked in the West by people who fear the consequences of mass immigration of people from the Middle East. Sounds racist, but then I have some Middle Eastern heritage. Probably not so racist then. But now it's getting interesting because on my occasional visits in the Middle East, I should expect to be asked the question, why are Western Europeans so generous and kind? And interestingly, I have never been asked that question. But I have very frequently been asked the question, which is the title of my talk. Now, of course, that might say something negative about Middle Easterners, probably lack of compassion, and so on. And there are some disturbing signs. For example, in German schoolyards, there's an insult used by immigrants from the Middle East for their German peers, and they call them Opfer, or victims. That's an odd insult, but it implies that those are people easily to be taken advantage of, and I'll try to find out if there's some truth to that, where it might come from. If you go even further east, in China, a new term was coined to refer to Western Europeans. They use Bai Zhua, and the literal translation, you can correct me, is white left. But the meaning is more or less the same as the German Gutmensch, and it means people who are naive because they want to appear as morally superior than others. And it's quite, I think, an interesting observation, and let's see if there's some truth to that or not. What the cultural and demographic factors that still distinguish Western Europe from Eastern Europe mostly have their basis in the Middle Ages, so I have to delve into some revisionist history of the Middle Ages, pick up where Sean has stopped, or even Keith, Akir, sorry. What is distinct about Western Europe in the Middle Ages is that we have at the same time a number of agricultural innovations and the military innovation. And those had, I think, quite important demographic impacts. The agricultural innovations are the free field crop rotation and the heavy plow. A heavy plow to be pulled by strong animals like horses and oxen. The military innovation is the knight in heavy armor on horseback, requires horses as well. And both in agriculture, as in this kind of military structure, the capital demand is higher than what a usual subsistence farming household could bring up. So it requires a kind of collaboration. You can't do free field crop rotation with heavy plow as a small subsistence farming household. But at the same time, it doesn't require the large-scale collectivist organization that we have observed in the ancient civilizations in the East and in the Far East, which are usually focused on irrigation projects, large-scale irrigation projects. So we have a pattern of mid-sized, small-scale productive units in Western Europe emerging, and they form a peculiar structure which is very much embedded in the feudal structure of Western Europe. Historians call it the bipartite manorialism. Why is it bipartite? There are two parts in it. Basically, it's three parts, but two major sides from which to look at it. It's the peasants, which have the private furrows on the fields. They don't have private lots around the houses because the rotation, they usually have furrows. And in English, it's called hides, I think, that the whole aggregate of the land that's tilled by the private farmer. And then there's the domain of the lord, from which, of course, he has the income to be a costly knight. And overarching over those two is a third part. Those are the commons. And the commons are not only meadows and forests, but interestingly also the oxen, the bulls, and water mills. Quite soon, water mills emerge as part of these commons. So I think the interesting thing about, or one way to define Western Europeans is probably that's the part where there's least tragedy of the commons. It was really part of a feudal structure, and that kind of feudal structure necessitated for people to fulfill functional roles. And it formed a peculiar synthesis with Christianity. Christianity was from the beginning a very anti-tribal religion. It forms a fraternity of believers at the expense of the larger biological extended family. Those two aspects were linked. How would they become linked? It was quite like working together with other people which are not part of your tribe and having a boss, someone who's bossing you around, that's the lord of the night. So it resembled a modern corporation in a certain sense. And as we've learned from the groundbreaking analysis of Professor Hoppe, if you have a decentralized structure with competition, then it may be the case that a small-scale monarchy can have incentives aligned with the subjects. Because, of course, the lords of the manors had an interest in the productivity of the whole thing, which comprised, of course, the private parts and the commons as well. So there's an interesting alignment, probably, of incentives. Didn't make great people out of those lords and knights, but I think it tends to explain a quite benevolent appreciation of politics in a certain sense and your superiors. This structure turned out to be quite productive, but of course only at the time. We see developing out of the commons of the water mills impressive machinery. And of course there's no necessity, but there's obviously a line to the Industrial Revolution later going on. And, usually historians don't pay that much attention to it, but those machineries were really very sophisticated, and you had entrepreneurs called the Hammerherren or the Hammer Lords running large-scale metalworks, industrial metalworks, already in the Middle Ages in Western Europe, which is quite interesting as well. And combining the anti-tribal orientation of Christianity, now you have people settling along functional lines, and husband and wife become functional, professional job descriptions, basically. For the small private unit, you need a husband and a wife in a kind of division of labor to run it, but it's kind of a job that you fulfill. So we see in a three-generation household, for example, that it's the second generation in charge. And the older generation, which in a tribal order would be the honored ancestors, they move out of the main house into something which in German is called the Ausgedinge, which you can't really translate into English, just a small house where they'll live later on. So it's all about having those capable in the prime of their life being head of the small productive unit. And marriage, of course, is the prerequisite of having the job. But being capable for the job is the prerequisite of marriage. And combined it now with the Christian laws of marriage, which of course you can't marry your cousins, you're quite restricted in who you are allowed to marry. You can't have children outside of wedlock, or I mean you can biologically, of course, but it's not taken that well. So you have quite a lot of pressure. And you can still see the demographic impact today. There's really a line going through Europe, and it's called the Heinal line by Hungarian scientist John Heinal. And he found out that along this line, the demographic patterns are different. And what's peculiar about Western Europe is that the age of marriage is much later, and the number of children is smaller ahead, already in the Middle Ages. Because you had, at the same time, possible ways without getting married, because you wouldn't be fit for the job in the bipartite manner. So you went to the monastery and so on. Usually farmhands were not related, they weren't your children, they were foreigners in a way, but inside this village scale collaboration going on. And of course, this manor is not the only cooperation in Western Europe at the time. We have the monasteries, which have a commercial function like a corporation, and they are, of course, a corporation in the juridical sense. We have the autonomous cities, and another corporation which I've talked about a few years ago, the university, of course. So we have a number of autonomous corporations in a quite decentralized scheme where political rule is decentralized and productive units are decentralized. What is now very controversial, that's why I was trigger warning in the beginning, I think it's quite likely that this peculiar situation led to selective pressures on the population. And I think it's likely that we could have observed a selection of more cooperative and more peaceful people, or people more fit for that kind of cooperation within that small scale system with commons. I think some of that is still left in the mentality. So I think this kind of structure selected for the best employees you could possibly have. Reliable, loyal people who know their place and remain at their place, but are able to show quite a high productivity in the end. And still, nowadays, you can see the difference, which is impressive. And sociologists say it's trust. It's a measure of trust. If you compare productivity, Germans are still very productive, which is surprising, I think, given the political structure and taxation and so on. I think the reason for that is that kind of historical selective pressure working in the Middle Ages. And I think it explains an idealized perception of politics as well, because those people were not only selected to be the ideal employees, but they're also the ideal subjects. They are most easily ruled. It's possible to rule a German with a letterhead and just send official looking letters and he'll do whatever you please. I think that's part of that cultural emergence that we can observe here. And of course, that tends to be abused in the end, if you're the ideal subject as well. And then another thing, the ideal employee tends to be the ideal debtor, paying back his debts. And I think that explains the incredible dynamics in the 19th century when Western Europe became capitalist, so to speak. Because unfortunately, this later development of capitalism, of course, had quite a high reliance on expansion of credit, as most of you know. I think this kind of dynamics delegitimized the structure of value, in particular the Christian structure of value, which was like the moral superstructure of this whole societal structure being there. And it was Goethe, I think, who recognized it as the first. He turned the coin velociferic, and took upon a combination of velocity. And he observed it's a very dynamic age, but there's something odd about it. There's something wrong about it. And I think he had the correct feeling something was wrong about it. For example, the German Bauernbefreiung, liberation of farmers, usually was just a transfer from farmhand to indebted laborer due to the peculiar situations. Goethe wrote, just as the steam engine can't be stifled, neither can the new morality. The briskness of trade, the rustle of paper money, the accumulating debts to pay off other debts, those are the monstrous elements to which a young man is exposed nowadays. So, of course, Goethe had a very prophetic appreciation of these economic distortions going on. So it's a kind of dynamics which is not entirely based on the preferences of the people. So I think it's no accident that socialism is basically a German idea. It's a counter-reaction to what's going on here. But not being in accordance with preferences of the people, at the same time you have this dynamic. And the traditional structures of value can't explain that. You don't go to the preacher anymore to help you understand the world. You go to the engineer or even, God beware, to the economist to help figure out what's going on and how you should behave. So I think because it was a belated industrialization with a high speed and not really based on the preferences of the population, you have it at all structure of the population. Once more structure is gone, you still have the impact of the cultural selection, which you have ideal employees, ideal debtors. Of more structure leads to something interesting. Kate Chesterton, who observed that he wrote, with the shattering of a religious scheme, it's not only the vices that are let loose. More importantly, it's the virtues that are let loose, and they wander more widely, and they cause more terrible damage. I think he's quite right. That. It was Arnold Gehlen, a German sociologist in the 60s, and in the 60s, of course, it had become obvious in a way, but he wrote already, I think, in 63, about a hypermorality or moral hypertrophy arising within Western Europe. And he gave an interesting explanation for that. He saw a particular group pushing that kind of hypermoralization. He identified the intellectuals. Now what's so peculiar about the intellectuals is that people who have very little practical responsibility. So they tend quite naturally towards an ethics of conviction, to use the term by Max Weber, or as Nassim Taleb calls it, they don't have skin in the game, so they make other people bear the costs. And of course you've all heard the term virtue signaling. It's scientifically incorrect, I think it's quite important. That signaling usually in evolutionary theory means that you incur costs in order to show your fitness. But the difference with the phenomenon we have now is that those costs are imposed on other people. And I think that's also behind the idea of the Bai Zhuo China, in Chinese parlance. What has happened apparently is that people are taken advantage of in a sense that a group of people can gain the status of morality without bearing the cost of it. With the structure gone, the moral structure gone, of course you just pick the best features that you can find without counterweight of other virtues, which should check them in a way. For example, you need prudence. Being showing caritas to someone and so on. So in a sense, maybe the question is not correctly asked, why are Western Europeans so naive? And I think Middle Easterners should be corrected when they ask that question. And I gave a quite paradoxical answer, I think, because a lot of things which I think are quite good about Western society, and of course it's the reliability, the functionality, the productivity of the people, they have a trade-off, of course, and you pay a price once you can't trust the structure, and once you can't trust that the incentives are aligned between those who are the overlords and those who are the peasants. So it's an institutional question. I think the tradition of the Austrian school, in particular Professor Hoppe, is quite at the spot on to look at the institutional structure that's happening here. But I think the cultural background explains it a lot better. I think the correct question to be asked is, why are Western Europeans still so productive and peaceful? And why are such good people ruled by and educated by such a wretched lot? Thanks for your patience. I hope I answered the question.